And on most occasions like this, the person introducing the speaker will say, "Our speaker needs no introduction," then pulls out a long sheet of paper and reads a list of accomplishments. But I won't do that. But on behalf of the student government here at ITC, we want to welcome Representative Bond here, and we hope that this will be an enlightening session for all of us. Mr. Bond.
I want to begin by apologizing for being so late and try to explain exactly what it is that kept me from being here earlier. This afternoon, some miles from Albany, Georgia, there was an automobile accident in which was killed two people, one of whom I didn't know and the other whom I knew quite well. And I think Mr. and Mrs. Cerny in the back row knew him very well, Mr. Slater King. And his brother had already left Albany and on his way to New York, and I had the unpleasant task of having to go to the airport to tell him that his brother had been killed in an automobile accident. And maybe I ought to just tell you a little bit about Mr. King and his family. He's no relation to the Martin Luther Kings, but he has a family which is unique in itself. There are seven brothers in the King family. Slater, who is deceased now, who very prosperous businessman in Albany in Southwest Georgia. C.B., who is the brother at the airport, who is the only black lawyer in Southwest Georgia. Preston, who is almost the youngest of the brothers, who was the first Southern black young man to refuse to go in the Army because he felt that his draft board in Albany, Georgia discriminated against him. Clennon King, who has run for president of the United States several times and probably the best known of all the King brothers, and three others whom I don't know. They have both parents still living, and I think their grandparents are still living. A really remarkable family. And both C.B. and his brother Slater were among the leaders of the movement in Albany, Georgia in 1960 and 1961, 62, and both have continued to be very prominent in the affairs of black people in that section of the state. Slater once ran for mayor of Albany at a time when it was dangerous to consider having black people run for mayors of rather small southern cities. C.B. ran for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District of Georgia 4 years ago. And they're both very fine men, and Slater will be missed not just by his family, but by large numbers of people from all over the country who knew him very well. So I want to apologize for being late. I also want to apologize for delivering a speech which I've delivered many times before, and the reason for it is I was interrupted while writing a new one this afternoon, so I've got to fall back on something that's rather old, but which I hope is still germane to the topic that's been set for the evening, which is the political crisis, or the crisis in politics in this country in 1969. This is an old speech which I have given before. I'm not like George Wallace, who gives the same speech every time. I give the same speech every other time. So if some of you have heard it already, I want to apologize for that. What I want to do in this speech tonight is try to describe where black people in the country find ourselves in a great many different ways, politically particularly, in 1969, and to try to go from a description of our condition to some of the ways we have tried over the past few years to improve our condition. Now, the first thing that strikes me about the condition of black people in the United States is that a great many things in our lives have changed over the past several years, but among those things which has changed most is our geographical position. That is, we used to be, as long ago, as 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, an rural population. But now, in 1969, we are becoming, and almost have become, a completely urban population. And that's the same kind of trend that you can see in studying other groups in the country, that most of America is composed of people who are urban people rather than rural people. To cite a few examples, in the city of Washington, our nation's capital, where we can't elect a dog catcher, much less a mayor, we are over 60% of the population. In Richmond, Virginia, Nashville, Tennessee, New Orleans, Louisiana, Jacksonville, Florida, Birmingham, Alabama, We are over 40% of the population. This city, Atlanta, Georgia, Compton, California, Gary, Indiana, Baltimore, Maryland, St. Louis, Newark, Detroit, Trenton, all of those cities are going to have majority black populations by 1975. Now, in addition to our having undergone that kind of change, we know in the past few years other sorts of things have changed for us as well. And most of those kinds of changes, or rather some of those kinds of changes, have been changes for the better. To give an example, we can now eat in places that we could never eat in before. We can go to school at schools that we never could attend before. We can sit in the front of buses that never used to stop for us before. There are more of us holding elective office in more parts of the country than ever before. And there are more of us making more money now than ever before. There are more of us registered to vote and participating in politics than ever before. But for most of us, things have not gotten better. They have tended over the past 30 years to get worse. Now let me substantiate that by reading to you from a speech delivered 3 years ago by former President Lyndon B. Johnson. President Johnson said, this was at a speech at Howard University in 1965, but he said then that in 1948, the 8% unemployment rate for Negro teenage boys was less than that for whites. But by 1964, the rate for Negroes had grown to 23%, as against 13% for whites. Between 1949 and 1959, the income of Negro men relative to white men declined and dropped in every section of the country. From 52 to 63, the median income of Negro families as compared to white actually dropped from 57% to 53%. Since 1947, the number of white families living in poverty has decreased 27%, while the number of non-white families living in poverty has decreased only 3%. The infant mortality rate, that is the rate at which children die in the first year of their lives, in 1940, for black people, was 70% greater than for white people. In 1962, there had been some change in that statistic. The figure was 90% greater. Now, to use President Johnson's figures, the rate of unemployment for Negroes and whites in 1930 was almost the same. By 1965, the rate for Negroes was twice as high. Now, when someone discusses those kinds of facts and figures, you must be honest and candid and admit that poverty is not the exclusive province of America's black people. There are in this country a great many poor white people as well. In fact, there are more poor white people than there are black people, rich or poor. But poor white people enjoy the rather dubious distinction of knowing they are not poor because they are white, but rather are poor in spite of their whiteness. We have to then assume that the racial problem in this country is one both of race and class. There are 3,500,000 Americans, both black and white, who will on next Monday morning be looking for work they will not find. Another million more, again both black and white, and no one knows how many million more, have given up looking for work and therefore are no longer counted as being unemployed by the Department of Labor. Unemployment in our neighborhoods runs at between 30 and 50%, as compared with about 4% for the nation as a whole. There are 357,000 black men and 419,000 black women who are officially out of work. There are another 300 to 400,000 who are included in the hidden jobless and aren't being counted as being unemployed. Unemployment for black young people between the ages of 16 and 21 is six times as high as for white people of the same age group. Now, if you were to examine the typical black ghetto dweller, the person to whom all of those kinds of statistics apply, this is what you'd find. First, if he's a young adult, there'd be better than a 50% chance he would have dropped out of high school. He'd not only be unemployed, but by current standards would be unemployable. He'd have no saleable skill. Neither of his parents would have gone beyond the eighth grade. He entered school at six, but because of overcrowding, would have attended half-day sessions. During his 6 years in elementary school, he would have attended four different schools. Now, the question for the future ought to be, what has been the past of this imaginary young man? What has been his history and the history of his parents? What sort of efforts were made by them, or for them, or on their behalf to improve their condition? Well, first, several things have been constant in the United States for a great many years, and among those things that have been constant have been racial violence. Since 1917, this country has had continuous sporadic periods of racial violence. Now, this violence has always occurred during periods when the nation was at war. Between 1917 and 1919, in 1943, and from 1965 into 1969. Now, since 1954, there have been various methods and techniques directed at solving the problem this imaginary, statistically correct young man has. These methods and techniques have included the sit-in demonstration, the nonviolent march, the pursuit of education as a breaker of barriers, the use of violence as an inducement to change, the challenging in the courts of segregation by law, and the thrust for power through political action. Now, each one of these very obviously has its own successes and its own failures. Legal action, as an example, brought in 1954 tremendous victory to black people, a statement from the nation's highest court that segregation in the public schools was illegal. But 14 years and 8 months later, in March of 1969, we discover there are more black children attending all black schools north of the Mason-Dixon line than there were in 1954. Now, sit-in demonstrations, nonviolent marches, have won the integrated lunch counter, the integrated toilet, the integrated bus station, the integrated movie theater, and the right to vote. Now, each of these first victories has had little meaning for most black people who are economically unable to enjoy them, and the last of these victories, the right to vote, has yet to win real bread and butter victories for the millions who are now voting for the first time. Now, education has often been suggested to black people as one means of improving our condition as a mass, but I'd like to suggest that education as a means of improving conditions dies every day that ghetto schools continue to teach that whiteness is rightness. Now, violence has been suggested as one sort of political technique to improve our condition, but I'd like to suggest here that violence has never had a real test in this country. And the present national mood would suggest to me that continued repression would follow another long, hot summer. Now, in the past few years of this imaginary young man I mentioned earlier, the country at large has begun to change. In 1964, the community that this imaginary young man lives in was promised several things, among them that a war on poverty would be fought and that poverty would soon be eliminated. But just 3 short years later, in 1967, the war against the Vietnamese people had rendered that promise, if it was ever meant, completely useless. Between 1961 and 1964, this country officially denounced violence and war as a means of settling disputes between people or between countries. But from 1965 to the present, violence has been the official policy of the government of the United States in settling her own disputes, and that belief, the belief in violence, has seeped down into the police stations and slums across the land. In 1964, this imaginary young slum dweller I mentioned before thought that he might get a job. But in 1969, the only full-time permanent job available to him is being a soldier. War has brewed anger in the black community and has given birth to the belief that nonviolence is only a joke to be played on or played by the black community. Now, when questions of violence come up, one might imagine that black people in all of the communities all over the lands ask ourselves these kinds of questions: whether or not the status quo, the sorts of lives that those less fortunate than those of us here tonight, is not that just as violent as any Watts or Newark or Detroit? Is it not violent to condemn to death twice the proportion of black babies as white babies in the first year of their lives? Is it not violent to send nearly twice the proportion of black men as white men to Vietnam to fight and die every year. Now, there are those people who believe that a nonviolent confrontation will force this government to turn its attention homeward and toward a real solution of the white problem in America. There are those who believe that progress of a sort is being made and will be made, and who believe, like Scarlett O'Hara, that tomorrow will be another and perhaps a better day. And there are those who are convinced that nothing good will come tomorrow unless the structure of today is changed, and there are those who will willingly kill and die on these streets, either in frustration or rage, or in the faint hope that from destruction will come a newer and a better day. Now, each of these again has its place. Nonviolent confrontations have their place. The English gave in to Gandhi's repeated massive nonviolent demonstrations, but one ought to remember that the English were said to have had a conscience, while this government is thought to have none. If this is any indication of conscience, out of all of the members of the United States House of Representatives, only 36 could be found who would support the recommendations of the President's Committee on Civil Disorders. Now, if one looks for a solution to the problem that faces us, a political solution particularly, one ought to look at the places where the problem is concentrated. Those places are called ghettos, and they are described by Dr. Kenneth Clark as social, political, educational, and above all, economic colonies. Their inhabitants are subject people, Dr. Clark says, victims of the greed, cruelty, insensitivity, guilt, and fear of their masters. Using that kind of description, the terms colony and colonialized people will then correctly describe the condition of those millions who tomorrow morning will be joining and deserting the mechanized feudal system of the South for the more highly mechanized and more highly segregated ghettos of the North and West. Now, from those colonies, North and South, must come a new kind of movement and a new method. And when one discusses new movements and new methods, one ought to think back to the time of an earlier colony that existed on the United States and the method it took to free itself from oppression. That method was not peaceful petition. It was not orderly, nonviolent, peaceful demonstrations. That method was not requesting a redress of grievances. That method was armed rebellion, insurrection, the seizure of property, death and destruction. That was the American way of 1776. Now, if a new kind of movement comes from the kind of movement that existed in the early 60s, it has to be several things. Among the things it must be is democratic, and that is with a small d. It must extend to every member of the black community the opportunity to have a say in who gets what from whom. Now, let me interrupt myself and say something about what politics really is. A great many people will tell you that politics is the art of the possible, which usually means some things are possible, most things are not. And others will tell you that politics is the art of the compromise, which to them means that in order to get what you want in politics, you have to compromise on some other things. But I've always thought that what politics really is the art of seeing who gets how much of what from whom. That's what is involved in it, seeing who gets how much of what from whom. And we are the who haven't been getting the how much of what from you know who. So if we had our politics together, it might be that we would have a say in who gets how much of what from whom. Now, this new kind of movement has to cast its votes as a unit, has to deal with problems on a local and a regional, a national and an international basis, and has to decide that freedoms that are not enjoyed in Watts or Sunflower County cannot be enjoyed in Westchester County. It has to declare itself in the interest of working people but not become the mistress of organized labor. It would have to pay as much attention to a streetlight in a 50-foot alley as it does to national legislation involving millions of people and to international complications involving the future of the world. It has to maintain a militance and an aggressiveness that will earn it the respect of those whom it seeks to lead. Now, if there are any kind of rules that are peculiar to this new movement, they would be these. Let me interrupt myself again and say these rules, which sound strange to some people, come from actually rather moderate sources. One comes from, one set of these rules comes from a former editor of Ebony Magazine, certainly not a revolutionary journal, and the other comes from a former professor at Atlanta University who now is at Duke University, which also is not a citadel of revolution. But these are the rules. First, that social, economic, educational, political, and physical segregation and discrimination are quite obviously very important for large numbers of white people. Secondly, that appeals made to justice and fair play are outmoded and useless when power, financial gain, and prestige are at stake. Thirdly, that positions of segregation and discrimination will be adhered to until change is forced through coercion, through threats, through power, or through violence. Next, that initiative for black political education and organization must come from within the black community and must be sustained on a day-by-day basis. Next, that the geographical distribution of black people makes black and white coalitions desirable, but only when based on racial self-interest and genuine equality between the coalescing groups. And finally, and most importantly, that racial self-interest, race consciousness, and racial solidarity must always be paramount in the deeds and words of black people. When self-interest is forgotten, organized racism will continue to dominate and frustrate the best organized political actions of any group of black people and will leave them powerless and defenseless. This new kind of movement has to address itself to several things: to solving America's white problem, to developing a new sophistication and consciousness in the black and white communities, and in making democracy safe for the world. Now, this kind of movement will only succeed if several things are done, and among those things that must be done is to begin a rejection of the kind of equality we are winning today. That kind of equality is giving us an equal chance to be poor, an equal chance to be unemployed, an equal chance to drop out of school, and we have already won, without fighting for it one bit, and a more than equal chance to fight for someone else's freedoms thousands of miles from home. That kind of equality has to be suppressed and replaced with an equality that provides full employment, guaranteed jobs or incomes, and makes the American nightmare become the American dream. Only when we shall have gotten ourselves together, only when we shall have decided who our enemies are and where the battleground ought to be, only when we know in our hearts we are right, and only when we demand that our worst off be treated as well as America's best off, will we begin to see whether this system and this method can make a difference in our lives. Having done all that, having put together that kind of movement, having put into motion the kinds of forces that would make up that sort of movement, one final and further thing would be needed. And that is something that commencement speakers always speak of, and it's called commitment. But in this instance, it's the kind of commitment that would have done several things. The kind of commitment that ought to have kept this section of the country, the South, in ferment from 1964 to the present, instead of our having seen the kind of de-escalation in this section of the country that we have seen, the kind of commitment that might have kept the Chicago police force busy for at least a day or so longer, the kind of commitment that might have ensured a choice and not an echo at the top of the ballot last November. And it will require that each person interested in a movement like that keep in mind a rhetorical question asked by the late Langston Hughes, who asked, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it fester like a raisin in the sun, or just explode?" For if this dream is deferred much longer, then an explosion will come. And in the words of an old song, and I'm sure this audience knows the song, usually when I speak to audiences, "Hey, what old song is that? I never heard that song." But it will be like the words of the old song that says, "God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time." Thank you.
What we're going to do now is we're going to open up for questions, and we will stay. Mr. Bond has said that he will be here open for questions for almost another half hour. So he will entertain your questions and repeat them so they might be taped for other discussions.
Yes, sir. Well, I think you need that kind of party if you believe that you will immediately have an effect on the national scene. And I think it's a mistake to think that any group of political activists is going to have an immediate effect on the national scene. That what I think it'd be better is to begin on a small way and begin to build upward. And on that level, it does not take a political party. I'd imagine it'd be desirable to have one. And there are one or two examples of black political parties in the South, one in Alabama, the Lowndes County Freedom Party, but I don't think it's absolutely necessary. And organized people don't need a party as much as they need, in my opinion, a notion themselves of what's important to them. Now, a party can help give them that, but they don't have to have a party to give it to them. Yes, sir. Well, I'll tell you this. If there had never been any violence in this country, you would be speaking with an English accent right now. So, I mean, no question but that it can serve a positive purpose. It just has done so in the past, will do so in the future. In the back. The question is about the bill I have before the House of Representatives. It's not before the House anymore. It has passed the House. It's in the Senate now. And what this bill says is that if suppose I am a landlord, I own a piece of property that you live in, and the city declares that this piece of property is unfit for human habitation. Well, under my bill, if it becomes law, then you won't have to pay me rent. You will pay it into an escrow account established by a bank, in a bank, rather. At the end of 6 months, if I haven't brought the building up to code standard, then you can withdraw the rent and go elsewhere. The trouble I find most people who are evicted from places that are demolished or declared unfit is that their standard of living, their income, is exactly the same, so they move into a house exactly like that they just moved out of. And the purpose of this, I hope the effect will be rather, is that people who do live in substandard housing have a chance to build up some money in the bank with which they can move into a little better housing. As I say in the legislature, it's a simple bill, does one thing and one thing only. It's good for the little man. And all politicians like the little man. Yes, sir. Should black people join with white people, or attempt to become a part of a white American society, or secede from it and attempt to build our own society? Well, I think that's not a decision that someone like myself can make for everybody. I like living on the block where I live, which is in a black neighborhood surrounded on four sides by black people. I'm not going to move anywhere. I like the work that I do in the legislature, and have come to the conclusion after not too much study that I'm not moving mountains in that body, but I like it. and I hope the people I represent are grateful for the efforts I make on their behalf. So I don't think it's something I can, you know, that ought to be dictated by any one person. I think that's a matter that people make up their minds about and by themselves and for themselves. I don't think there is a best way for black people. I disagree with people. When I was, I don't know how old, I was going to say your age. When I was younger, people used to say to me, all you all need is this, and they'd name something. But then someone else would say, no, that's not right. Here's what you all need. If only you all had this, then be all right. And ever since then, I've been suspicious of people who say there's one thing we need, and that's this. Because I don't believe there's one thing we need. I think there are many things that we need, and there are many different things that suit many different ones of us. I believe, as the popular song says, that there are different strokes for different folks. The question is, what do I have to say about people who criticize James Farmer for having joined the Nixon administration? Well, it'd be easy for me to say I wouldn't do it, but then I wasn't asked, you see, and doubt if I will be. But I have no criticism of him for doing that. I mean, I don't mind him doing it, and I'm not in a position to say, don't do it, Jim, because I think he does think he's being of some service. I think he will find in this particular instance that he's likely to be mistaken, because I think his superior, Mr. Finch, is not the decent man that he has been made out to be in some people's eyes. I think he may be one of the most dangerous men in all among all the selectees in the Nixon cabinet. He is the man who has given 5 school districts in the South 60 additional days in which to decide whether or not they will obey a 14-year-old decision of the United States Supreme Court. So I think Mr. Farmer may be mistaken in his belief that he can help black people. At the same time, I may be mistaken, he may do so, but I'd have no criticism of
him. In light of the statistic that you mentioned about population ship of black in large cities, to what extent do you think black will have on the election of the next mayor of Atlanta?
The question is, what effect will black people have on the election of the next mayor of Atlanta? Well, it depends on several things. First, the raw statistics. If there's no increase in black registration, we are 38% of the registered voters in this city. We are 48% of the population, but only 38% of the registered voters. There's also going to be a purge of the poll of the list this time, coming just before the mayoralty election, which will strike several thousand black names and some white names as well from the list. But that 38%, if it votes as a unit, is likely to be the deciding vote, I think, as it has been in past elections in this city, decides who will be the mayor. I don't think there's going to be a black mayor in this city, that the two cities that have black mayors, Cleveland and Gary, Indiana, have 50% or close to 50% black registration. And that's what I think it takes, because white people are not politically mature enough to vote for a black person. We are, apparently, because we've been doing it for, since we've been voting.
Mr. Bond,
question is, what are the motivations of the sponsors of the House bill which will dissolve the municipalities in Fulton County and make them one with the county? Well, I'm not able to look into their minds. I'll tell you this. On Monday evening, I went to the Playboy Club with Roy Harris, who some of you know publishes a newspaper in Augusta, Georgia. He told me, and he knows much more about politics in the state than I do. He was George Wallace's campaign manager in Georgia and Speaker of the House for 8 years before I was born, as a matter of fact. He told me that it's to keep you people down. And I think Mr. Harris is older than I am and knows more about it, and he's right. That's what The question is, are we or are we not headed toward a racial conflict? I really don't think there's any way to predict. I think it's probable that that's going to happen. I have no notion of what the outcome would be. I would suggest, I just think that, again, population figures would suggest we'd be on the losing end. I want to go back to something you said earlier about the police being the defenders of white supremacy. That is really unfortunate for us in a way, and it's unfortunate for us in a way because it makes us react against them, that is the police, who are not the people responsible for themselves, you see. And if we see the police as the single enemy, then we are deluding ourselves. It's not the individual policeman who assigned himself to a particular block or who said to himself, I'm going to behave in a certain way, but it is someone superior to him in the chain of command and someone superior to that superior. So I think we make a mistake if we believe that the police singly are enemies of ours. I think they are enemies of ours, but they are not enemies of ours singly. But I have no notion as to whether there will be a race conflict or as to what the outcome would be. Be prepared? Well, I think everybody should be prepared for anything. If it looks cloudy, you should get an umbrella. I am prepared. I'm not sure I understand your question. Could you put it again?
How would you address these new rules that you have to outline to concentrated economic people that exist?
Well, I think the question is, how would my rules fit an attack on economic power rather than political power? Well, I think they are adjustable to fit an economic rather than a political situation. I try to apply them to politics. That was the topic I was given to speak on, and also the thing in which I feel the most competent. But I think they're adjustable to fit an economic rather than a political situation, although I think the difficulty is much greater when facing an economic force than a political one. But I think they're adjustable. The same things apply. Unity applies whether you are making a political or an economic fight. Cohesiveness, race consciousness applies in an economic racial fight as it does in a political fight. So I think they adjust.
I'm going to push my question a little bit further. I'm interested in it and my opinion. And that
The question is the two-party system as it exists presently in the United States a viable means through which black people can work toward achieving the goals that we have? First, let me say I don't want to attempt to be dodging your question, but I think the only way to answer it is to try it and see and fail at doing it, and then the answer would be no. But I do think a general answer, and that's all I feel prepared to give, is the answer is no, that it's not a viable means or structure through which we can work toward genuine solutions to our problems. That I think the kind of political apparatus that we need is one that is directly responsible to us and us alone. I think the difficulty of building that is that some past attempts at building that kind of structure have begun from the top down rather than from the bottom up. And my opinion is that when they begin from the top down, they're doomed to failure. This will not succeed. But when and if they are seriously begun in different locations with a rather general idea in common toward the common purpose of welding together an association of black interest political parties or a coalition with, say, Spanish-American interest parties, Mexican-American interest parties, then I think that is a can lead to a viable structure. Question is, what do I mean by community socialism? Well, first, let me say something about black capitalism. Now, this city is the center of black capital development in the United States. Along Hunter Street and Auburn Avenue, there's concentrated a great deal of wealth, and it's held largely in black hands. And it's a fine achievement for those who have done so. They have enriched themselves at the same time have provided some employment for other people. But capitalism as a political system quite obviously not solve the problems white people have. And since we are largely an imitative group, why should we believe that if it doesn't work for them, it would work for us? I just, you know, see no future in it solving the kinds of problems that we have. I'm sure that an application of black capitalism, as I've heard President Nixon describe it, would enrich and employ some black people, would build up additional entrepreneurs in the black community, and would generally result in higher standard of living for some black people, maybe many, but I tend to doubt it. My notion of community socialism is this, that suppose this building we are in now is a textile mill, and it's here in the middle of this community surrounded by black people on all sides, and the people in the neighborhood have jobs at this mill. Now, under black capitalism, we assume that this factory would be owned by one or two black entrepreneurs who would be assisted in their ownership through loans and funds granted either by private industry or the federal government. And they would reap the profits from this business, would pay back the loans, and would then put the profits in their pocket. Now, under my system, the same thing would prevail with this difference. It would not be owned singly or by one or two or three or four people, but would be owned by the community itself. The profit would go back into the community, so you could set up a similar enterprise someplace else or do something else with the money. The notion would be that the profit would not go into the pockets of two or three people, but would rather go into the broader pockets of the whole community. And that's what I mean by the term.
In light of what happened at the Democratic Convention, National Convention, what is your relationship with the Democrats in the
Well, I have almost no relationship with the official Democratic Party. I'm run for office as a Democrat, so my name appears on the rolls as a Democratic member of the state legislature, so I get invited to all the party functions. I'm invited to the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner. Was sent two tickets. I was assumed for my wife and myself. They are $50 each. I returned them, not feeling I could afford that kind of meal. And so I have almost no relationship at all with them. Just never met the party chairman. Just don't know.
talking about community socialism, I wonder how this would differ from our current
Well, they may reap some benefits. The difference is that if I can buy a little stock in General Motors, but I'm never going to get as rich as Charlie Wilson, who used to be the president. And he's not going to give me any of the money that my stock has helped him get as president, and the majority stockholders in General Motors are not going to share any of their stock with me. I forgot to say some of my explanation that the stock under my scheme would be sold only to bona fide residents of the community. That is, if you lived in Sandy Springs, you couldn't buy any. If you lived here and moved to Sandy Springs, you'd have to sell it back to the corporation or back to someone else who lived in the community. And you could buy as many shares as you wanted, but you could only vote one share. And that'd be the difference. Money would stay here. It'd circulate here. And no one would take it out of the community. Sure. Well, the first place, this factory, assume again this were a textile factory. A textile factory would be run by a manager, as all textile factories are. And he would want to get ahead because he'd want to please his employers, who would be the community corporation that would own his business. His employers, the community corporation, would want him to get ahead because they'd want increased profit to come back into the community to provide more jobs. So that motive for getting ahead would still be there. It just wouldn't be aimed toward simple acquisition of wealth, but toward acquisition of wealth aimed at improving life as a whole in the total community. No, I don't take that for granted at all. I take it for granted that you will be able to control the evil impulses of some men and channel them into creative possibilities for the good of others. And I take what's been happening in China as an example, that you had the creation of elites in China, and you've had a revolution within the revolution. And a young man now in jail in Argentina has written a book about a revolution within the revolution. And I think what happened in China and some of the things that he wrote about suggest that kind of struggle is a constant one, that your revolution is achieved, the old order is upset, a new order is imposed, and time may come when the new order will have to be upset and a new one imposed on that. And I think it is a continual process because of the lack of love that you speak about, which rests in men's heart.
Then you start working on yourself because you're going to have some of those managers might be
shocked. Oh, they might be, but if they
start overthrowing them and saying, come
there on again. Oh, sure. Well, I think I hope it's not inevitable, but it might be. Constantly on the lookout for sharks.
I'm
question is, for the benefit of the man who is recording it for classroom use, I've been told, is can there be race consciousness and racial unity with an open door policy? Now, I don't think there really can from the beginning, but I think there can be once I'd achieve. I think I've achieved it. So I don't, presence of, you know, other forces don't bother me. But I think it is necessary on a great many occasions for us to be completely by ourselves in our own meetings where there's no one there but us. But I don't think that's a rule that has to be applied to every occasion. The question is, what is the right of a majority when a minority protests? Well, the right of the majority is to protect the minority and ensure its right to protest. That's the right of the majority. The question is, what is my definition of what I call the white problem in America? Well, the white problem in America is the problem that has caused us to suffer as we have. And we don't have a problem. See, we have many problems. We don't have a single problem. We suffer from the white problem. It has caused our problems. So the major problem is the white problem. We could solve one of our problems and we'd still be faced with this other major white problem. So we don't have to solve any one of our problems, but we have to solve the white problem, which is the system of racism that has pervaded in this country since it was founded. When that's solved, then all of the attendant problems that we have will be solved, just will disappear like magic, almost. Well, I've been to one college where that request was made and granted, Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. The girls, the black girls, wanted a black house, a house that they could live in, where they could be with people who played the same kind of music and enjoyed the same kind of music that they did, and I guess ate the same kind of food that they did, and shared the same kinds of problems that they did, whether it would go back or not, those kinds of problems that some black women still have. So they made the request of the school, and I think they had some difficulty in the school granted, and I think the school acted properly. That I don't think you ought to have. One thing that bothers me, I'll tell you about the present demand for black history courses, and that is this, that I don't believe that every American university can or ought to offer complete, all-inclusive courses in black history. I think the result of that's likely to be that most of them will be very poor. That I would rather see schools like these here, or say Howard, or Fisk, or another collection of black colleges become experts in, say, one black history, one black African history, one black American history, and so on. That I think these colleges have got to find their own specialties and become the best in those, rather than thinking that every American university, white or black, is going to be the best in offering, in making an offering of black courses. I think that just demeans the whole. It's just not going to work. There have only been 100 black PhDs in history graduated in the history of this country. Who's going to teach all these courses? The ones who are teaching it at Morehouse are going to get a big offer from Harvard, and they'll go there. And what will the poor Morehouse fellows do? They'll sulk all the time.
Yeah.
I would guess that if they are supported by federal funds, and they ought to be, I don't think you can have a double standard and say that the University of Mississippi ought to integrate its law school and then say that another school someplace else ought to segregate some of its facilities. I don't think you can have a double standard. But I do think schools can find ways to provide separate facilities. I mean, it's done, it's not done as strictly in this center as it is in others, but you have right off the campus of Morehouse a small one-story house called the Canterbury Club. Now, it's there for all the students, which is fortunate for the students who attend the AU Center, but its primary purpose for the Episcopalian students. I've never seen any of the Roman Catholic students in the AU Center protesting. Some campuses I've been to, they have a Newman Club, which again is primarily for the Roman Catholic students. I've never heard of the Baptist students getting up in arms, and they have homes and houses for Jewish students. I imagine some large universities may even have them for Buddhist students, but and no uproar is raised by the non-Buddhist students. So, you know, I think there are ways that universities can do what's been done at Cornell and what's been done at other schools without running into that kind of prohibition that's involved with acceptance of federal funds.